Good afternoon. This is Charles Melville. I'm speaking from home, of course, and I'm welcoming you to our first ever online lecture. You will obviously realize it's impossible to have our summer lecture in the normal way at the British Academy. And so we're having a lecture online, and in fact, it's going to be a panel discussion. We're a little bit delayed because one of our panelists, Pooya Afshar, is unfortunately struggling to join the session. So he'll be, I hope, joining us a little bit later. Now, the first thing I just want to say before we start is that this is being recorded. So that's for the panelists to know, and also any questions that might come in, and our answers are going to be recorded. Well, this is a major topic, of course, the Shahnameh, and this is, we believe, the celebration or the year of the poet's death, 2020, a millennium since his death in 1020. Of course, the fact is that this may not be the case. There are various dates given for his death. But anyway, it seems like a good idea to get this one in first. We've had celebrations of his birth in 1934. We've had celebrations of the completion of the Shahnameh in 2010. And now we think that it's a good moment to celebrate his death, which may have been 1020 or it may have been 1025. So we can have another bite of the cherry maybe in 5 years' time. Well, the Shahnameh has had a great influence in literature and art and in the modern world. And I'm very grateful to Firuza Melville for proposing to BIPs that this should be the main topic for our first lecture, because of course it is a great opportunity. And I'd also like to thank her for cooperating and working together with Sarah Stewart, our outreach officer, and Nargis Farzad, also at SOAS, to organize this panel today. And also, although you can't see her, we're all very aware here of Kendall Livingston in the background, who is managing the IT. BIPs has already supported this sort of event on the Shahnameh because it supported Firuza's visit to Iran in 2016 to assist with the organization of an exhibition devoted to the Shahnameh then and now, East and West, and it was called Shahnameh Ravayate Manandagar, the permanent narration. And many of the topics there, of course, came up both in terms of literature and art and in the impact of the Shahnameh stories on modern creative artists, be they video artists or other painters and ceramicists and so on. So this is a subject that never ceases, I should say, to be relevant. Why did a poem written 1,000 years ago and a poet who died 1,000 years ago still command such attention in so many fields of cultural and artistic activity? And to help us answer some of these questions, we have a panel today. And we're breaking it up into three sections. Our first speaker will be Professor Gabrielle Vandenberg, who's the Professor of the Cultural History of Iran and Central Asia, who's been asked to talk about the Shahnameh as literature and its sort of enduring qualities as a literary masterpiece, which obviously partly explains why people go on reading it. If it was an appallingly badly written poem, I'm quite sure that it would have disappeared long ago, along with many others. And our second speaker will be Barbara Brend, who is a great Islamic art historian. She's written many books, but in the of particular relevance to today's panel, she curated an exhibition in 2010 at the Fitzwilliam Museum, which was celebrating the completion of the poem. And in the same year, to mark this event, also produced a beautiful book dedicated to the Juki Shahnameh, which is one of the finest manuscripts of the poem, illustrated manuscripts, belonging to the Royal Asiatic Society and now safely stored in the Cambridge University Library. And our third speaker is Professor Pooya Afshar, who I very much hope will be able to join us soon, who is associate professor of art and design at the University of Massachusetts. And he is a video artist, among others. In fact, he had a work in the exhibition I mentioned at the Aran Gallery in Tehran in 2016. And he came to Cambridge last year to show his video Rustam in Wonderland, and I hope he's going to be talking about that, and also why the stories of the Shahnameh and Rustam in particular transferred so well into a comment on contemporary life in modern Iran. So the idea is we have three talks of 15 minutes each, or thereabouts, and then we'll have a Q&A session. And people are very willing to send in a question. You can't do this on chat. I think your chat has been disabled, but you can do it through the Q&A thing at the bottom of your screen. And it would help if you indicated who the question was directed to. And I should also say, we have no idea of our audience because, of course, it's such a beautiful day anyway in the UK that everyone may decide to go and lie in the garden. But of course, it will be impossible under normal circumstances to answer all the questions that may come in. And I'm afraid there'll be no warning if your question is going to be ignored. It's not intended to be a rudeness. It's simply that one has to try to manage the questions as they come in a timely manner. So without more ado, that's more than enough from me. I would like to ask Gabrielle Vandenberg if she would open the panel discussions. Thank you.
Yes, thank you so much, Charles. I'm trying to share, of course, now my my PowerPoint presentation, and I am going to talk, as I have been asked, on Shahnameh as literature. So, the Shahnameh, or Book of Kings, celebrated its first millennium, as you just said, in 2010, and now 10 years later, we commemorate that 1,000 years ago, in the year 411 of the Hejra, Ferdowsi passed away in his hometown, the city of Tus, where he was buried in his own garden. Now, today, this is the site of a grand mausoleum complex, befitting a poet who is credited with the preservation of Iranian identity through his great epic on the kings and heroes of Iran. The present mausoleum in Tus, and I'll just show a map with Tus in a red square. So the present mausoleum in Tus is a 20th century construction, but reports on pilgrimages to his grave in that same place are abundantly present in Persian literature. One of the first about whom we know that he made such a pilgrimage is Nizamiye Aruziye Samarkandi, who speaks about his ziyarat to Ferdowsi's tomb in the year 510 of the Hejra, so around 1116 or 17, almost 100 years after Ferdowsi was buried there. In his Chahar Maghale, or Four Discourses, on the four offices indispensable to a ruler, Nizamiye Aruzi provides a vivid account on Ferdowsi, the creation of the Shahnameh, and its disappointing reception at the court of Ghazna. The story is part of the second discourse of the book, entitled On the Essence of the Science of Poetry and on the Competence of the Poet. In this entertaining story, Nizamiye Aruzi relates how Ferdowsi worked on his magnum opus for 25 years in order to supply his daughter with a dowry, and how he dedicated his epic poem to the great Sultan Mahmud of Ghazna, and how he brought it to Mahmud's court. Mahmud, ill-informed by his courtiers, paid Ferdowsi a pitiful sum of money that was in no measure equal to the value of the Shahnameh. Ferdowsi took his leave and gave the 20,000 dirhams that he had received away, fled the city of Ghazna, and found refuge with the Balvandid ruler, Shahriyar, in Tabaristan, to whom he proposed to dedicate the Shahnameh instead. And in Tabaristan, he composed a satire on Mahmud that was bought by Shahriyar in order to keep Ferdowsi safe from harm. But years later, so Nizamiye Aruzi tells us, while on one of his many campaigns to India, Sultan Mahmud was struck by the brilliance of an appropriate verse quoted by his minister. And I hope you can see the verse here. So in the verse says, Agajos bekam manayat jawab, mano gorzo meydano afrasiyab. To which Mahmoud answered, "Im beit kirast ke mardi azu hamizayat." So, if the answer is not to my liking, it will be me, the mace, the battlefield, and Afrasiyab. Unto which Mahmoud said, "Whose verse is this, which oozes manliness?" And he was told, "It is from poor Abul Qasim Firdausi, who toiled for 25 years and did not see any fruit from it." So when he was told that the author of the verse was none other than this poor Firdausi, Mahmoud felt bitter remorse and ordered a proper reward to be brought to Tus. One of the most moving passages in the account of Nizamiya Aruzi is how a caravan worth of 60,000 dinars reached the city just as the corpse of Firdausi was taken out of the city gate. This well-known, romantic and tragic story about Firdausi has been very influential in shaping the image of Firdausi and the Shahnameh. Since Nizamiya Aruzi was one of the first to write extensively about Firdausi and the creation of the Shahnameh, his work is often used as a source of information. Firdausi as an author comes to life in this account, and we learn many things, also about those surrounding him, such as his daughter, his scribe, Ali Deylam, and his reciter, Abu Dulaf. But this account is not only a valuable, if perhaps unreliable, source of information, it is also, and perhaps more so, a literary work that offers some insights into the literary appraisal of Firdausi's epic in the 12th century. To demonstrate Firdausi's poetic art, Nizamiya Aruzi says the following, and I have here the text in both the original and in the translation of E.G. Brown. So I cite the translation, "And to this end, he left nothing undone, raising his verse as high as heaven and causing it in sweet fluency to resemble running water. What genius indeed could raise verse to such an height as he does in the letter written by Zal to Sam, the son of Nariman in Mazandaran, when he desired to ally himself with Rudabe, the daughter of the king of Kabul." He then quotes, I hope you can see this, six verses from the Shahnameh, and I'll just read a few. Yeki name farmud nazdik Sam, sarasar durud o navid o khiram, nukhost az jahan afarin yad kard ke hamdad farmud o hamdad kard. And so it goes on. I'm not going to translate this because this is just a letter, and I just want to say something about this, and that is what Nizamiya Aruzi has to say about this, because he says, and that's also on the slide, he says, "Man dar ajam sukhani bedin fasahat nemi binam va dar besyari az sukhan arab ham." So in eloquence, I know of no poetry in Persian which equals this, and but little even in Arabic, which says something about his appraisal for Arabic poetry. There are in Nizamiya Aruzi a few more examples of Firdausi's verses, but this is the one passage he brings forward to illustrate Firdausi's great eloquence or fasahat. These verses come from the beginning of the Shahnameh, from the episode of the Iranian king Manuchehr. It was during Manuchehr's rule that the great hero of the Shahnameh, Rostam, was born, son of Zal and Rudabeh. At this point in the Shahnameh, stories on the heroes from Sistan, vassals of the kings of Iran, start to play a substantial role. Firdausi brilliantly connected this storyline to the main storyline on the kings of Iran. The fact that Nizamiya Aruzi expresses his admiration for Firdausi's eloquence via a passage which comes from the Sistani storyline illustrates its importance and popularity from an early date onwards. At the same time, the verses quoted form an excellent example of praise poetry, at the time an important genre. This fits the context of Nizamiya Aruzi's work very well. He naturally focuses on court poetry, composed for rulers and other patrons, for whom poets function as artisans of glory. Though Firdausi is known as a dehqan, and therefore to some extent of independent means, it is clear from Nizamiya Aruzi's account that Firdausi too sought court patronage. In the centuries after Firdausi's death, court patronage became crucial for the transmission and dissemination of the Shahnameh. A symbol of kingship and a rich source for kingship ideology, the Shahnameh soon began to play a role in the legitimizing enterprise of rulers who sought to be connected with the elites of the past, and to forge a relationship between themselves and the Shahnameh by having royal manuscripts produced in their name. This mechanism certainly perpetuated the fame of the Shahnameh. In modern times, the Shahnameh became a cherished pawn in nationalist discourse, and started to be characterized as a national epic. But for many centuries, the Shahnameh seems to have been a book of kings for kings, an imperial epic. That is not to say that the text of the Shahnameh did not have a life beyond the court. It is, however, much more difficult to trace its impact and history beyond the context of the court and outside the framework of courtly cultural production. Now, I've been invited here to speak about the Shahnameh as literature, and I must admit that this sounds easier than it is, as there is actually no straightforward definition of what is meant by the word literature, by the term literature, especially at this time and age. Is literature the same as fiction, and should we consider the Shahnameh to be fiction? I'm not sure if this is a useful classification. But today, the term literature, like its Persian equivalent adabiyat, implies a value judgment. It describes texts that have been composed and are read or listened to for the value they embody. Literature may be entertaining, but texts that serve no other purpose than to entertain are usually not described as literature. Literature has an extra layer or an extra added value. To go back to the term for literature in Persian, adabiyat, that is a relatively modern word that goes back to the Arabic word adab, a versatile concept with a moral component. According to Jalal Khalqi Mudlaq, who wrote on adab as a concept, it may refer to culture, education, good behavior, politeness, and is closely linked to the concept of ethics. One answer to the question I was supposed to dwell upon, why is the Shahnameh important as literature, relates to this. The Shahnameh is a repository of stories which illustrate and explain morals, ethics, ways to behave, and ways to make sense of the world. It has a strong wisdom literature, or andars, component, and as such, it also functioned as a mirror for princes. This wisdom repository is, moreover, directly related to an illustrious, specifically Iranian past, a past that became highly idealized through the ages. The Shahnameh went global, one may say, when the importance of Persian as a literary language increased in the centuries after the Shahnameh's completion. The geographical scope of Persian from the 13th to the 19th century, proverbially stretching from the Balkans to Bengal, is expressed by the term Persianate world, and the Shahnameh in no small measure contributed to the cosmopolitization of Persian. The universal and timeless quality of the ethics enclosed in the powerful stories of the Shahnameh appealed to a large and multilingual audience. I would like to offer here an example of this, no doubt well known to many of you. It comes from one of the most famous episodes of the Shahnameh, the story of Rostam and Sohrab. At this stage of the Shahnameh, we are in the midst of a great war between Iran and Turan, between Kaikavos, the glorious but fallible king of Iran, and the evil witch king of Turan, Afrasiab. Rostam fights for Kaikavos. He has a son, Sohrab, from a short liaison with Tahmineh, a son he never met. Sohrab grew up to be a warrior for Turan. They meet in the battlefield without knowing each other's identity, and inevitably the tragedy unfolds. Rostam kills his own son, and when he finds out, he is struck by grief. Firdowsi upon this contemplates, and I just cry, yes, he contemplates, Jahana shigifta ki kerdar tost, ham az to shikaste, ham az to durost. Az in do yeki ra najumbid mer, khirad dur bod, meh nanamud cher. Hami bache ra bazdanat sutur, che mahi be darya, che dar dasht gur. Nadanat hami mardom az ranj az, yeki dushmani ra ze varzand baz. So, O world, how full of wonders are your doings. Sometimes you break, sometimes you heal. None of these two felt any love move inside them. Wisdom was far, love did not show its face. The animal will recognize its young, the fish in the sea, and the onager in the steppe. Mankind, burdened by desire, does not see its child in an enemy. Now, the natural compassion and intuition of animals and the human lack of it is a recurring motive in the Shahnameh, interwoven into many stories. What is expressed in these verses has a universal and timeless quality, which has lost nothing of its value. The story of Rostam and Sohrab ends on a sad note. Sohrab dies very young, and that is the end of it, or not. Both in the manuscript tradition and in the oral traditions of the Shahnameh, many sequels to this story circulate. These sequels are a remake of Sohrab's story. The outline of Sohrab and Rostam is taken as the basis for a new story, about the son of Sohrab, Borzu or Barzu, who is a champion like his father, and who comes to face his grandfather in single combat. There are many versions of this story, but all of them give Rostam an opportunity to get acquainted with his grandson, a more happy ending, at least, than the story of Rostam and Sohrab in the Shahnameh. The story on Barzu is known as Barzunameh. It can be found hidden in Shahnameh manuscripts, interpolated between Shahnameh episodes. The Sistani epic cycle, that is, the stories dealing with the ancestors and descendants of Rostam, predates Firdowsi. Firdowsi included part of this cycle in his Shahnameh, but there was still room for more, at least according to the many, often anonymous spin-offs of Sistani cycle episodes in the Shahnameh. They fit seamlessly into the Shahnameh tradition, as they have been composed in the same meter as the Shahnameh, the Mutaqareb. In manuscripts, they are skillfully linked to the preceding episode by a transition verse, as if they are an integral part of the Shahnameh. But they can also be found in separate volumes. At Leiden University Library, for example, we have a copy of the Shabrangnameh. And that is a few pictures of the Shabrangnameh. Shabrang is the son of the famous white div, the white demon from Mazandaran, who plays a crucial role in the Haft Khan or Seven Trials of Rostam in the Shahnameh. In this sequel, the battle continues. The Shabrangnameh, like other spin-offs of Shahnameh stories, is actually quite one-dimensional. It focuses on long winding battles and much bloodshed. Therefore, this epic and many other of these epics, these sequels, have been characterized rather dismissively as secondary epics. However, their existence from an early date onwards shows that the Shahnameh was indeed a living epic. The reception history of the Shahnameh, which is much broader than what I just described, is a clear demonstration of the lasting impact of Firdowsi through the ages, up until the present day, in a very large area. In the Pamir Mountains of Tajikistan, a beautiful song circulates on the fate of Tahmineh, the mother of Sohrab, and I'll just show the song and I'm not going to read all of it. And it starts Tahmineyam, Tahmineyam, Azdar Doram, Donimeyam. And it's sung by Madazin Bahromov in Tusyan, a small village in the Pamir Mountains of Tajikistan. So this is basically a version of Tahmineh's lament, which has also been not the same version, but versions of this have also been part of Shahnameh manuscripts. And in modern Persian, including also Tajik literature, there are many examples in which the Shahnameh plays a direct or indirect role. A notable example is Simin Daneshvar's Sabashun, a bestseller which appeared in 1969 and has been translated into many languages. Its title refers to a ritual connected with Seyavash, the Iranian prince who fell victim to injustice and was murdered by Afrosiab. The tragic end of Yusuf in the novel of Simin and Daneshvar in many ways mirrors the story of Siavash. Simin and Daneshvar includes at the opening of her novel a verse from Hafez, and that translates, "The king of Turks was listening to the word of calumniators, may some shame be his for wronging of Siavash," in the translation of Peter Avery. The Shahnameh thus permeates Persian literature. Allusions to themes and motives of the Shahnameh abound in many literary texts. I did not have an opportunity to say much about the formal aspects of the Shahnameh, but I would like to go briefly into this in connection to Saadi's Bustan, completed in 655-1257. Saadi composed this work in Mutaqareb, in the same meter as the Shahnameh, and a meter that is associated with heroic epic ever since the Shahnameh came into being, even though Saadi's Bustan cannot be really characterized as such. However, Saadi honors Firdowsi in a tazmin, or quotation, in the second chapter of his Bustan, which is entitled Da Ehsan, on doing good. And this is the line, it's hopefully visible here. It says, Chikhosh goft Firdowsi paqzad ke rahmat bar an torbat paq bad. Mayazar az muri ke dane kash ast ke jan darad o jan shirin khosh ast. How well the noble-born Firdowsi spoke. May mercy be on his pure grave. Do not injure the ant that is carrying grain, for he has a soul, and the sweet soul is beautiful. This is a jawab, an answer, to Firdowsi's verse, which is also on the slide. Makosh murakiro ki ruzi kashast, ki unis jon darado jon khashast. Do not kill the little ant that is toiling for its daily food, for he too has a soul, and the soul is sweet. In the Shahnameh, this is what Iraj, Prince Iraj, says when Tur is about to kill him, his brother, in the context of an advice to his brother not to lower himself to killing the weak. These verses, I think, form part of the answer to the question, why is the Shahnameh important as literature and for Persian literature? Thank you.
Thank you, Gabrielle. I think we have a little time because I regret to say we have not found Puya on our screen yet. But anyway, we'll save any questions that come in for later. Thank you very much for your presentation. And now we're going to switch seamlessly to Dr. Barbara Brend, who is going to discuss the impact of the Shahnameh on Persian miniature paintings and all that therein is. Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you. Well, now, as we know, the Shahnameh is an extraordinarily long work and so has many possible moments when illustration could be inserted. And when we look at princely manuscripts, we suppose that the moments for illustration are chosen with some degree of care. And that probably there is some sort of a reference to the patron or his achievements or his concerns. So the illustrations in a way are a sort of tool for the princely patron, and I'm only talking princely manuscripts this time, for reflecting on life in general or for the patron's life in particular. Now, can we do it, Oin? Where's it gone? Ah, here it is. Hooray. So I'm going to talk about six very grand manuscripts, and this is the first one. This one now goes by the name of the Great Mongol Shahnameh, but we only know it in sort of bits and pieces that have survived. And I think it's got 58 surviving pictures. It was probably made for the Ilkhanid ruler Abu Sa'id sometime about 1330 to 35, or possibly for his successor, but we won't go into that. It was probably designed by his vizier since 1328, Ghiyas-ed-Din Muhammad, who was the son of the great vizier Rashid-ed-Din. So that's the sort of high Mongol setting. Now here we have Zav, the seventh ruler, the son of Tahmasp. This, for some reason, or survival or whatever, is the grandest of the enthroned scenes that remain to us. We have, and Zav, I should say, he lasts only a very short time. He gets to the throne rather old. He has 5 years, which do quite well, except he does have a famine, loses some territory, but on the whole, he gets a kind of good mark. Now, at the bottom left, the white-haired gentleman in the snow leopard coat is Zal, the father of Rustam. And I'm a bit interested in the fact that he seems to be getting rather more attention than the king himself here. So I think it's possible that there's a sort of quiet reference on the part of the artist to Ghiyas-ed-Din Muhammad, sort of beside and in addition to the king. Then we have the courtiers round the throne in different hats, probably indicating different areas of the world. We have two honorific swords behind the throne, and Zav is sitting it very nicely. His women are tucked away decently under rather small windows. And I'd just like to mention in the upper right, there is a bit of willow, which is something derived from Chinese painting, but we're going to see more of it. Here we are with Alexander the Great, Iskander, and he's been traveling the world, and he has set up a challenge to the ruler, a princely ruler in India, the Fur, or Fur. Alexander is a little bit worried because the Indians are liable to use elephants in battle, which scare his horses. So he has an iron cavalry made, and they're loaded with naphtha, so they're able to blow flames out of their muzzles. So we have this tremendous picture, which is, I think, perhaps the most exhilarating of all the battle scenes. Alexander Iskander is coming in from the right, which is normal in Persian work, that being the right to left being the reading direction. And normally what you might call our side comes in from the right. Anyway, it's a very exciting picture. Onwards. Here we have a hero, a single episode for a hero. And obviously there's a lot of these in the work. This is Bahram Gur. He has come upon a dragon, which he's dispatching. It's an extraordinary picture in the way it functions, because it draws you in. As you can see, the creature loops round the tree in an almost three-dimensional manner. But almost more important is the fact we see Bahram from the back. We are almost on his shoulder. It's almost us who are dealing with the dragon. We have a nice halo around his head so that you can spot it, and his helmet doesn't get lost in those mountains. But it's part, I think, of a sort of desire of the artist for the reader's total engagement in the scene. And then there is much tragedy, as Gabrielle has already mentioned. It comes, there are the ups and the down moments. Here we have the beers of Rustam and his brother Zavare, who've been treacherously caused to die by the king of Kabul and Shagard, another half-brother. So they're being carried along. And again, we get the feeling that we're in the picture, because you have this sort of sensation that the beers might almost topple over on top of us. The artist has put in his own bit, which is the elephant carrying Rustam's horse, Raksh. Rustam being such a great hero, his horse has to have super strength. So it's of a super size and presumably needs an elephant to carry it. But it's rather beautiful that even in death, Raksh is nuzzling the feet of Rustam. And then we have these very sort of dedicated, keen people who are carrying the biers. Their faces marked with sorrow. They have in the picture bare feet and dark mourning clothes. And several scholars have pointed out that this may be a particular reference to a grand Mongol gentleman, Amir Chupan, who was carried from with his son in biers from Herat, where he died, to Medina. So there may be a sort of particular side reference there. Now, second manuscript, we have now got about 60 years later, and Timur is ruling in Samarkand, and his sons and grandsons are ruling in the provinces. So there's a Shahnameh manuscript which lives in Dublin and is datable by another portion of it to 800 or 1397. It's assumed to have been made in Shiraz, which was then under the control of a character called Mirza Pir Muhammad, a grandson of Timur by his son Umar Sheikh. It has been demonstrated that the pictures must be later than the text. If they're 12 years later, they come under another son, but if they're only a few years later, they're still under Mirza Pir Muhammad. Anyway, we have Rustam. You feel it's a sort of young man's manuscript. It's full of energy. We have these two very compact pictures of Rustam. On the left, he is dispatching the white deer. The figures are large in the picture, and the scene is carefully delineated, cut off for us, amongst this colourful rock. Rustam must carve the liver out of the white deer and take it to his king Kekaus, who has been captured by bad demons in Mazandaran and temporarily blinded. On the right, we have another demon episode. In this one, Rustam has, he's looking for lost horses of the king, and he goes to sleep on his travels, and this bad demon comes and digs him up together with a piece of landscape and is going to throw him to his death. But the demon, unfortunately for the demon, offers him the choice of being thrown into the sea or onto the rock. And Rustam, knowing that the demon will do the opposite of what he says, opts for the rock, so he gets a soft landing in the sea. You can see Rustam's speaking gesture with his left hand. You can see he's working it out while holding on grimly with his right hand. The div has unfortunately got rather damaged over time, but I can't help feeling there's an element of comedy in this. One feels that this div is actually going to fall into the sea with the whole contraption. And he reminds me of those scenes that you get in cartoon films, where some bad or foolish creature gets to the edge of a precipice and goes over, and then paddles desperately with its legs as it begins to fall. So these are two pictures, but this is the last picture in the manuscript, and I think it's rather key to the thought. Bahram Gur has been brought up in Arabia, but he learns that his father, the king, has died in Iran, and he goes to Iran to try and claim the throne, but somebody else has been put in as an alternative. So they have a contest. Bahram Gur takes first shot at grabbing the crown from between two lions, and of course he's going to be able to do it. But what I feel about this picture is you have this energetic and confident young man, and I think the thought of who is going to be able to grab the crown must be high amongst the agenda of all the Timurid princes for a great part of their lives. Then, moving into the 1430s and 1440s, there are three sons of Shahrukh. So grandsons of Timur, sons of Shahrukh, who was at this point ruling from Herat. And this manuscript is about 1430, if Charles agrees. And it's for Ibrahim Sultan, who was then ruler in Shiraz. So it has a very grand, energetic, but very austere, stripped down sort of style, where you can see the pages imaging conflict immediately. We had Rustam already with the white div. He proceeds on and encounters the king of the divs of Mazandaran, who is a bad lot, and he's in combat with him. And then the king, who's a sorcerer, turns himself to stone, which he thinks is going to be the final word. But Rustam, being preternaturally strong, is able to lift this stone up and carry it back to the Iranian camp, where he announces he's going to break it up. And the thought of being dismantled in this radical way causes the king to return to his normal shape, where, however, he is executed. Now, this one also has a picture of the first king, Gayumas, who at the beginnings of civilization is enthroned on rock and has taught his people to wear animal skins, and the animals have not yet realized that this is rather bad news for them. I would like to point out there is on the upper right a sort of a willow, rather like that we saw in the Mongol picture. And This manuscript also has in it four double pages, which appear to relate to the life of Ibrahim himself. So it's as though he wants to get himself into the Shahnameh. He wants to be a part of it. So this is the right-hand side of a double page on hunting, and you will see that he is in no ordinary landscape. He has above him a canopy of rock, which is quite as bizarre as the throne of Gayumas, and low sticking out of the side of it, there is a willow, which you wouldn't expect to grow on the top of a hillside. Right, the next son of Shahrukh that I'm going to mention is Faisungur. He's born in 1397. His manuscript is of 833-1430. He lives quite a lot of his life actually in Herat. His manuscript has scenes of battle in it, but it's also notable for several scenes of enthronement. So one rather thinks that he has a sort of, he has his eye on the throne and a degree of comfortable feeling that he's very likely to get it. The style is of course similar, I mean dissimilar from that in Ibrahim's. We've got much more color, more detail, more luxury, figures smaller in the picture. This is Lochras, the son of Kekosro, the great and wonderful and good king, who, when he's going to leave the world, hands the throne over to Lochras. So it's an image of a very easy transition in kingship. And I think that's where Baisinger thinks and hopes that he's going to be. Only, in fact, he dies of drink 3 years later, so he doesn't make it. Another picture for him is that of Faramarz, the son of Rustam, overseeing the entombment of his father Rustam and uncle Zavare, the ones that we saw being carried in the biers earlier. The text tells us that they were put on golden thrones, but we don't get that here. But what we do get is a concentration on detail of architecture and also quite a lot of inscriptions running here, there, everywhere, all around it. And I think this is Baisungur sort of reflecting on his own achievements. His mother, Jawaharshad, had been patron of a mosque at the shrine of Imam Reza in Mashhad, building from 1416 to 18. And in 1417-18, Baisungur himself had designed a mighty inscription for it. So I think this is what he's recalling for himself or anyone else who cares to see this manuscript. Here we have the third of the sons of Shahrukh, and not the third absolutely, but the third who has a Shahnameh manuscript. And this is Muhammad Juki. And Gabrielle has very nicely set up these pictures for me. On the left, we have Rustam. He has been in pursuit of his horse Raksh, which has been stolen by some bad people. And this leads him into the alien land of Turan. And he's forced to ask for lodging from a local ruler. And at midnight comes the daughter of the ruler and asks, well, points out, demands, asks, that she would like to have his baby. So we have this marvelous picture of Rustam looking as though he can hardly believe his luck. And Tahmine coming in, looking rather embarrassed but resolute. So I think it's quite possible that in this picture for Muhammad Juki, there's a reference to the fact that in 1435, he was pursuing one of his father's enemy, a member of the Karakuyunlu, and he gets himself not into Turan, but way over west into Asia Minor, to Erzin Jong, where he asks for lodging. And after a certain time, he returns from that lodging with the daughter of the local ruler there, added among his wives, his new bride. So I think there's quite a close reference there. On the other side, we have, on the right, we have Rustam kills Sohrab. And as Gabriel has indicated, there's a whole build-up to this. It isn't just one final moment. But there are messages that should have got through and could have got through, and people who didn't say the right thing, so that Rustam doesn't know that he's plunging his dagger into the heart of his son. And he'll only realize it when the son's clothing is opened and it reveals a jewel that he's given to, that Rustam had given to Tahmini. But what I think is particular about this manuscript, this picture, whose composition is after all basically rather simple, paired horses and a death group, is the feeling of mourning conveyed by this lilac or mauve ground and the rocky ridges which almost seem to weep into it. And unlike Ibrahim and Baisenghul, who might have had the thoughts of the throne, Muhammad Yuki has no pictures of enthronement and obviously doesn't expect that he's going to make it there. And indeed, he dies possibly poisoned by his mother. However, before that, we have this picture from the introduction to that Shahnameh, which I think is perhaps the most beautiful of to portray Firdausi himself. Again, Gabriel has set this up. Here is Firdausi. He is encountering the court poets of Ghazni. They are not at all keen that he should join them. They set him a poetic test, which, however, he is able to manage. So we assume that Firdausi is the gentleman in brown. But what I wanted to point out, especially for today, is the beauty of the landscape surrounding. So it's more beautiful, more lush, more floriferous than any of the other pictures in the manuscript. And I think, in a way, the artist is paying tribute to the poetical powers of Firdausi. Then, jumping forward to the Safavid world, when the Safavids, who are possibly of Kurdish origin, have established Shiism as a state religion from 1501 in Azerbaijan. And a manuscript is perhaps begun for the first Safavid ruler, Ismail, who goes 1501 to 24, and then continued and finished for his son, Shah Tahmasp, who rules 24 to 76. Now, already we note that the second patron there, Tahmasp, has a name out of the Shahnameh. You might remember from the beginning, Zav was the son of Tahmasp. So we have a picture here which is extraordinarily different from the picture for Ibrahim. Gayomas is again enthroned in rock, but the rock has become splendid and many-coloured. He is looking towards right of the picture, his son Siamak, who is unfortunately going to be killed by a black deev, but will be avenged by his grandson Hoshang, the second ruler of the Shahnameh, who is the young man standing on the left. So in a way, it's emphasizing the continuity of this dynasty, which is here shown almost as a sort of heavenly apotheosis of kingship in a paradisal setting with water and greenery and animals. Here, Hoshang, having come to rule, has discovered fire, which is a great plus, and he's instituted the feast of Sade, a winter feast, Sade, which is part of the Persian tradition. So in a sense, there's a feeling that the manuscript is being taken back from the Mongols and the Timurids into Persian custody. And then lastly, I want to show you, this picture is from the end of the manuscript. I may have omitted to say the manuscript's got 258 pictures, which are now to a considerable extent dispersed. So here we have Hosroparviz, a real Sasanian king, and he is at the moment in a good and flourishing moment of his kingdom. He's had some ups and downs, and he's going to be killed later, but here's a moment when all is well. There is a musician called Barbad, who wants to be taken onto his staff and has arranged to be concealed in a cypress tree from which he can play his tunes and convince the young prince of his skill as a musician. So this is what's happening. The young prince is celebrating the Persian feast of Nowruz. So again, we've got an emphasis on the Persian-Iranian background. And we have this wonderful feeling of hope. It comes rather near the end of this manuscript, where the other pictures are, I must say, getting a little bit dull. So this is a wonderful moment of respite. Thank you. That's what I wanted to say. Get out.
Thank you very much, Barbara, for that lovely tour of the highlights of the Persian arts of the book, referring to the Shahnameh. Well, I'm very glad to say that Puya Afshar has joined us after a small but nerve-wracking technical hitch. And so to bring us up to date, without more ado, since both our speakers so far have gone way over their 15 minutes, Puya, over to you to talk about modern interpretations of the Shahnameh in contemporary art. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Charles. And sorry for the delay. I guess I'm a millennial, but technology wasn't agreeing with me. I'm very sorry. Okay, so I'll try to be brief and talk about our project, Rostam in Wonderland, which is a collaboration between Part Collective and Suriland Studios in Tehran. But before we get there, I would like to talk about catharsis and how an artist in diaspora can deal with difficulties of displacement and immigration by going back to the roots and basically restructuring an identity as an Iranian or in this case Persian. So in 2010, when I went back to 2009, when I went back to Iran after a few years of studying Shahnameh through the work of Jalal Khaleghi Motlaq, Dr. Minovi, and Zabiullah Safa, I decided to work on a project called Pahlavan, the Hero, which was about the characters of Shahnameh, Rostam, Furud, Sohrab, Esfandiar. And the point of doing that project was basically reflecting myself through the lens of Ferdowsi and how he decided to portray these characters. I'm going to switch over to my presentation so I can show you some of the imagery. Okay. All right. So as you can see from left, I have Rostam, then I have Furud, and then I have Sohrab. And what I wanted to focus in portraying these characters was the stipulations that they were dealing with in these stories. As we know, Ferdowsi didn't invent these characters. He gathered information from whomever he could, to basically create a persona for the masses that they could relate to. For me, in that period of time, it was really important to see the struggles of these characters. And that's why you can see that these characters are morphed into themselves, and you can feel the tension they probably were dealing with themselves in those stories. For example, in Rostam's Haft Khan, or the Seven Conquests, what was really interesting to me as an artist was what the character is going through more than anything else, more than the story, the plot, on its own. So from here, I moved on and focused on the story of Zal. Same thing, Zal is one of my favorite characters. And he was one of the few characters in Shahnameh that I felt was more in peace with himself. And I decided to make a film, an animated film about Zal and Rudabe through the story of tambur, which is basically a Kurdish instrument. And I was basing the story on Kurdish Shahnameh and the story of Zal in that book. I'm not gonna play the entire film because the focus of the this talk is on Rostam in Wonderland, but I wanted to show you the aesthetics that I preferred showing my character and my story. As you can see, it has a very miniature-esque aesthetic and look. From here, and focusing on some of these characters in Shahnameh, I moved on to a project called Seven Conquests of Story. And it focuses on how these stories that were gathered by Ferdowsi and many more authors, how they survived time and how they got to us. It is very important to me how Ferdowsi chose these stories or chose the right version for these stories. But what I did was to focus on these characters. These are acrylic paint on fabric. And I studied some of these stories, the more famous ones, like Rustam and Sohrab in this case, and the elements that I thought were pivotal in carrying the story. And it was really interesting because when I did this project, obviously I was going through the books and these stories from other authors as well in the United States, but then I decided to show them in Iran. I took them to Tehran, I had an exhibition, and the main goal was to basically have a conversation, a dialogue about these stories, and trying to see if people recognize them and if people recognize themselves in these stories. This is the story of Siavash in Fire, and I painted basically the important parts of the story. And whenever a person, mostly a young person, would come into the gallery, I would start a conversation with them, trying to see if they recognize any of the stories or any of the characters. And unfortunately, at that time, they wouldn't. This is the story of Zahak. And I thought to myself, well, as a nation, as a society, we definitely can learn from these stories. They have something to teach us. As we know, oral storytelling has a role, and that is educating our children. In this case, Ferdowsi is the parent, and we are the children through time after the 1,000 years, and we still can learn from these stories and learn from the stories of these characters. This is Seven Conquests of Rostam. And as you can see, I myself was dealing with the issues of masculinity in our society, and that's why I portrayed Rostam this way. It's purely a personal take on the story, but as I said before, the main goal was to create a conversation. Also, we had an installation, which was a collaboration with Neda Moritpur. This was an interactive project. We painted verses from Shahnameh on tiles, and we asked people to change the poem if they wanted to, with these words around the frame. Many people did, just because it rhymed and they felt that, you know, they can create a new story. But also there were a few people that said, this is what happened in history when some people decided to change a verse based on their personal taste, and well, the information was incorrect. So this was an interactive project. People were invited to either participate or not. And it was also revolving around the idea of the seven conquests that stories take in order to get to us. During that time, I was fortunate to get to know Suroosh Rezaei, which is a prominent animator in Tehran. And we decided to do an experiment with the character Rostam. And we decided to take him into contemporary Iran in the first episode, specifically in Tehran, and see how he interacts with the society and our problems. We wanted to see how collective memory and value systems in Shahnameh are formed, and also how we reflect our behavior as a nation through Shahnameh, and studying how we interact when anonymously cruising the web and comment on different things that we find online. This was an animated project in 5 episodes, but what we portrayed, and it's a satirical project, but what we wanted to see was not how people follow the plot of the animation, but the important part was to see how, again, they interact online. Because of the limitations in Iran and the filtering on internet, we couldn't go through any of the obviously the TV channels in Iran. So we decided to choose YouTube and invited people to go through VPNs proxies in order to view the animations. And what was important was what they commented underneath the videos. So for example, the first episode, which we're gonna take a look at in a moment, is about the sanctions on medicine in Iran. And it was really important to see how people see this issue and how they talk about it among themselves when they're anonymous and they're hiding behind their user ID online. Another episode that I really liked is about racism in Iran and how Iranians can be racist toward Afghans in Iran. And because people would hide behind their user IDs and they could be anonymous, they would say the truth in the comments. And that sparked a conversation. So when you see the video, the little jokes here and there are not important at all. The idea is how we as a nation, as a collective, see things and how we educate ourselves and how we interact. So I did the character design, and the project was created by me, and Surush was the person who animated and directed the episodes. And the reason I wanted to show you Zal in the beginning, the story of Zal, the animated project, was to show you that that is not my aesthetic. What you see in Rostam in Wonderland is Surush's. And that's really important because I've been outside of Iran for 20 years. I'm out of touch, to be honest. I'm half and half, an Iranian American, if you say. But Surush lives in Iran and he dealt with everyday issues of life. And it was important to see what he finds and what is important to someone that is up to date on what's going on in the country. So I think it was a very successful project in carving out and some sort of identity for this character that gradually started to adapt to the new system. So to begin with, in the first episode, Rostam gets surprised by what he sees. By the fifth episode, he's learning the ways, the shortcuts, which might be a good thing, might not be a good thing. But the important part is that we can see him and hopefully see ourselves in him and reflect and see what would what we would do if we were in his place. All right, so I have the first episode. I'm not sure, Charles, do we have time to see the entire episode or should we just see a part of it? You're muted.
Yeah. How long does it last?
I think it's 6 minutes.
I guess people will vote with their feet. I mean, we're almost certainly going to go a bit over time here, but I'm sure people would like to see it. So okay. They all can right. Just sign out if they don't want to. So there we go. Why not?
All right, sure. Okay. So as you can see, the small gags there, the little jokes that most of them actually are inside jokes in Iran, it might be not familiar with someone that had been living outside of Iran for years. But the point is to see ourselves in him. Some people commented on these videos saying, why are you making fun of Rustam when we told them we're not making fun of him, we're basically making fun of ourselves. Because he represents us and how he deals with these issues, even if they're really small, basically is our story. Thank you very much. That's all from me.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Puya. It's nice to see that again. Interesting Chinese drugs has a sort of sickeningly contemporary note to it. Right, well, we have some questions. This is where things get difficult. I don't know quite how we're going to handle this. We've had some questions which I'm hoping some of the panelists may like to answer themselves if they haven't already done so. I don't think I'm the only person who could do this, but since we've Puya's just finished, I have a question here, Puya. I don't know if you can see this yet. If you look on question and answer, could you tell me something about the visual sources that have inspired you?
For Rostam in Wonderland, the character design is basically based on what I've done before as an animator. And obviously for the looks of the characters based on what has been done so far. But for the paintings, I've been looking at old manuscripts, but also since I've been trained as a painter, studying anatomy and figure drawing myself, mostly under the same school of Lucian Freud or Bacon, Francis Bacon. It's basically a mixture of these. I didn't specifically base my paintings on a particular style, but it's something that I've developed over the years, and that's how it comes out. Yes.
Great, thank you. Barbara, this is a bit random. It's quite difficult to keep on top of these. Barbara, there's one here. Did you see this? Would you like to answer it live? I'm wondering about the skin tones in the paintings.
Oh, I thought you said you were going to. The note says Charles Melville is going to answer this question.
Oh, really? Gosh, I didn't realize that. But it might be nice if you did.
It is interesting. It is various. Maybe it actually reflects a Mongol court. I don't know. You will have seen perhaps that in the Iskander picture, Indians were given a darker skin tone. And we quite often see dark skin tones for unspecified sailors on ships. There was a sort of association probably that ships tended to be sailed by Indians. If you want to go more into it, there is an article available on the showing of black people in Persian painting by Professor Robert Hillenbrand, which is probably around on the internet somewhere. I think that's what I'd like to say basically.
Okay, thank you. Of course, we could also entertain some questions across the panels. I mean, if any of us have questions for anybody else.
I have something to add, if you don't mind.
Yes, please.
I saw a comment here, which is really interesting. I saw a comment here, someone saying this cartoon is stupid.
Yes.
And you should invite Dr. Jalal Khalili Mutlaq here to talk. That is exactly what we were after when someone chats. It's easier for us to type things on the web. If this comment by a professor was not a written one on the web, it wouldn't say this cartoon is stupid, right? But we show ourselves this way. And yes, obviously, Dr. Jalal Khalili Mutlaq is awesome. That's one of the persons that basically made me get interested in Shahnameh as a young immigrant, Iranian immigrant to the United States. So I was drawn into Shahnameh by the work of these scholars. But do you think people in Iran living their everyday life are going to be drawn into that as well that way? No. The reason this cartoon or this animation is very simplified is to draw in masses and engage them in the conversation. And then because it's simple to digest, we can explore more into deeper and deeper and deeper issues. So that I just wanted to mention that.
Thank you. Gabrielle, there's a question here from Pegah Shahbaz. Did you see that? Thank you.
I did see it, and I actually thought that's an interesting question. So in how far was the Shahnameh influential for the same kind of epics used or made for non-Iranian or non-Muslim rulers? Now, non-Muslim rulers, I wouldn't know, to be honest, but I think that's something Pegah herself works on. But as for the non-Iranian rulers, that's an entirely different issue, because we know that the Shahnameh was especially cherished by Turkic rulers. I think you can even argue that thanks to the patronage of Turkic or rulers from Turkic descent, the Shahnameh really, you know, got quite a boost. So, and I was referring in my written answer at least to Timur and Timur Nameh, but also guiding her towards you, because I think you work on this kind of epics. So that's more like your topic, so to speak.
Well, I mean, just very briefly, it's more the point of the non-Iranian rulers. I mean, you could say Timur, or in fact, of course, that was written after the death of Timur, but Hasafi's verse chronicle. But I think that it's clear that the whole genre of celebrating kingship in verse was something that was appropriated quite willingly. I mean, there is even the George Name, you know, for George, oh, yes. Written in India, and there are many other examples of sort of emulations of the Shahnameh in different cultural and geographical zones. So Well, essentially, this is an enormous question that I'd be very happy to have a conversation about it later. But there is, of course, an enormous impact. It's not just the Shahnameh itself and this sort of secondary epics that Gabrielle referred to, you know, the so-called Sistan cycle, where later poets were sort of scooping up elements of the story they thought Ferdowsi had left out. I mean, this is transferring the idea to other milieu, as I say, in other courts, particularly, as Gabrielle referred to, it's really court poetry. Of course, in the Ottoman Empire, there were several, they had a Shahnameh writer who was celebrating the deeds of the Ottoman sultans in verse that was emulating, Persian verse that was emulating the Shahnameh. So that's a sort of a brief answer to that question. Thank you. This, of course, is the unrehearsed part of the program. The number of participants has gone up, actually, since we started, rather than down, which is rather remarkable. I'll try to find another question here. This is perhaps one, I don't know, for Puya. Did you see this? What is the role of the Shahnameh in the narrative of glorification of the pre-Islamic past in the years preceding the constitutional revolution? So 19th century, I suppose, and before. Do you detect any?
I cannot see the question.
It should be addressed. They should be. If you look in Q&A, unfortunately, it's quite difficult to see the whole lot.
How do you make sure that you are not?
If you go to open, there are nine. I found it in there. No, it wasn't her. Sorry, it was. She's appeared.
It's not only for mining the younger generations.
Oh, we've got a whole lot more, golly. Disappeared again. I can't see them all.
Yeah, I can't see. I can't find it. I was trying to answer a question earlier. The question by Sarah Kante says, any upcoming projects with Suruj? Unfortunately, not. Suruj is very busy these days making animation in Iran, not about Shahnameh or Rostam, but he's very busy. I saw a different question also. Question for, oh, there you go. How do you make sure that you are not demonizing our national myth? Do you have a known inventory of some critical concepts that you wish to convey? But this is Rostam and Iran. So how do we make sure that we're not demonizing by having this conversation, by not hiding or escaping from it? The role of satire can sometimes sting. And that is exactly what it should do. It should be a tool to basically bring truth out, you know, in a sense, tickle some issues to make them interact with you. In this case, yes, it might feel that we're demonizing these characters or we're making fun of them, but in fact, it is who we are as a nation these days. We made our episode about racism in Iran and Afghans 8 years ago. And recently, a few weeks back, we heard all those stories about throwing Afghans into the river by Iranians. So they still go on. These events occur, unfortunately, in the year 2020. But we can just make it better by having a dialogue, I think.
Thank you. Of course, it's an inevitable consequence of the way the questions are coming that we're jumping around a bit. I thought there was one caught my eye because the word Mongols was in it. I've lost it now, but it was one about the encampments and what do we see in the Shahnameh? And I assume essentially that this is a reference to the visual depiction. Of course, the tents are a very major part, I think. Barbara could answer this if she felt like it better than me, if you can find the actual question.
I saw the question.
I saw it too.
I've just typed the answer saying that if it's tentage you want to consult the works of Peter Andrews.
Yes.
Which, I mean, will have a certain amount of encampment round it, won't it?
Yes.
Ah. Yeah, or David Durand-Guedi, did he also work on...
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting getting this attached to the Mongols, because of course the regime under the Mongols, they were very much a mobile regime and they weren't really city dwellers at all. And the fact that the Shahnameh really started to be illustrated in the Mongol period and immediately after under Timur and his successors, where the same lifestyle, really, it wasn't a palace-centered lifestyle. The tents do play a very big part. And if you look at many of these miniatures, they're all taking place out of doors, which of course would be the artist's own, a court artist's own experience of court life. The chances are they wouldn't be in a palace somewhere. We have one here, the Shahnameh is still remarkably under-referenced in mainstream modern works of non-Iranians compared to ancient Greek, Roman or Japanese tales. Why is that? Well, I could start by saying it's a disgrace. this is partly what this sort of session is trying to do. And in fact, the work we're doing in Cambridge in the Shahnameh Centre and of course other colleagues and scholars as well. I mean, Persian, unfortunately, or Iran is almost a dirty word at the moment. And this, unfortunately, has an impact on people's interest and knowledge of Iran and her culture. And of course, it isn't widely referenced. It's a sort of a niche area of research and interest among Persian scholars, whether they be Iranians or Europeans. And of course, the major obstacle to this is the language, but there are good translations. And, you know, I hope that this sort of event and that any follow-up that takes place will help to give the Shahnameh more prominence, which it certainly deserves. Anyone else want to say anything else on that topic?
On translations?
Well, we've got a question here, and I've already recommended Dick Davis. I don't know how to get rid of a question that's already been answered. I'm sorry, it's cluttering up there.
Look, in addition to Dick Davis, which is the easy way to do it, I would recommend Warner and Warner,
yes,
which is much longer and has a huge critical apparatus.
And is available, I think, as a PDF these days, because it's been out of print since it was...
Well, it came back in print in about 2000.
Oh, wonderful. Okay.
Right.
Does anyone have a reference to the references that Ferdowsi used to create the characters? This is really for Gabrielle. I mean...
Yeah, that's a huge
this
question,
is the great...
Yeah, well, we know Ferdowsi himself refers to his sources to some extent in the Shahnameh. And there was a tradition of writing books for kings. And we know he had access to, or at least we assume, he had access to the prose Shahnameh of Abd al-Razzaq. So yeah, those were our references. But apart from that, what is interesting, or what I find always fascinating in the Shahnameh, is that he brought in Ferdowsi, that is, the Sistani epic cycle, of which we know something too from before Ferdowsi, for example, from the wall paintings in Panjakent in present-day Tajikistan. There is a tradition there. The problem is, of course, that we cannot access that tradition very easily. And even for the so-called Ghadai Namaks, the books of kings for kings in Middle Persian, well, many of them are simply, or many of them, it's a lost tradition. So there's a lot of guesswork there and speculation, and there are many people who have been working on this. I think, for example, Turaj Dariayi is one of them. I think I would advise people to look into that. But there is, of course, a lot, but also a lot is uncertain and will remain uncertain, I'm afraid. And people always looking, or Khalifa Madlak certainly did that to a large extent, looking for references in the Shahnameh itself. But there's always the issue, and that was also my point about what is literature, the issue of how should we evaluate these references. So that's also a perennial problem.
Thank you. There are one or two more.
Can I just go back? There was a question on in how far Ferdowsi might have been influenced by Western epics. like Virgil yes. and Homer. Well, I think not at all, to be honest. I didn't see any icons. Of course, epics, I remember when having to defend a grant proposal that there was a classic amongst the people who interviewed me, and she was really interested in the connections between, the Greek-Persian cycle and the Persian epic cycle, that being the Sistani cycle, so the follow-ups on Homer's epic. I guess the thing is that many things do happen without there necessarily being a sort of connection. So to my knowledge, there is no real connection, or at least Firdowsi did not know, I would venture to say, about Greek epic poetry or Latin for that matter. But of course, there were many other things he did know about. And it's a bit, again, I can say it's not the case, but God knows, but I don't think so. Let's put it that way. I think he knew Middle Persian and Arabic, question. But not Greek. So.
I have a question now. Why do you think tragedy repeats in the work of Firdowsi, Homer, and Virgil? Isn't it interesting that they focus so much on tragedy?
It is, and I feel because when I was thinking again about the let's say the later epics or secondary epics is an easy name for these sequels, these spin-offs. The fact that they are not perhaps even, you know, if you'd like to attach this label of literature, which I don't really like that much, but if you'd like to do that. I remember from, for example, I think this was Mahmoud Omid Salar who said, like, you know, Barzunamet or some of these epics, that's simply not literature. It's from a different, it's like oral poetry. It has a different standard. Then you get into the discussion of, well, is oral poetry or is orality something which is, you know, less valuable or less high than, you know, than written literature? I think that's a difficult field if you get into that. At least it needs a lot of discussion. But what you can say, and I've been editing together with Abul Fazl Khatibi, the Shabrang Nome, so I've seen all these verses. And what you can see there is that it's the fact that it's a sequel sometimes means that you know, the things are taken up that should have been ended. Perhaps the end of the end of the story on the YD, for example, is a wonderful end. If you go and continue, nothing more will come of it. The same goes in a way, although I do like Borzunome very much, but still it is, it's a repetition, and the fact that it ends in a tragedy in the Shahnameh, so Sohrab dies and that's it, that in itself makes it also a story people really feel, fall for and are moved by. While if there is, that really sounds awful what I'm going to say now, happy endings often do not amount to good literature, I'm afraid. If you just look, but this is really not a sort of academic statement, that's just my own experience too. And I guess it's yours as well, or isn't it?
Indeed.
There is a lot of tragedy in Persian poetry, especially the Shahnameh, it's true. I had a thought actually, Puya, this is slightly off the wall, but looking at your early pictures you showed of Rustam and Farood, it occurred to me they had a sort of similarity to some of Francis Bacon's work. I wonder if you sort of influenced by that or not influenced, you know what
yes.
I mean?
Yes.
Just the thought, I mean, he has a very tormented figures, doesn't he? All tying themselves up in knots.
Yes, Freud and Bacon, the British figure painting of the 50s, 60s. Because I studied under Ma'ajon Hormozi at CalArts in California, which was basically a student of Freud and knew Bacon. So that's why, yes. But that is also a very, those are very old paintings. There's a, well, when I say very old, 10 years old, I think my style has changed quite significantly.
Yeah. Well, of course, in a way, Iranian art, of course, it hasn't just sort of developed along its own straight line. The whole question, I mean, in a way, it's going back to this one about Homer. I mean, as you know, the Shahnameh was called the Homer of Persia, you know, and Iranian artists now are as prominent in the West. Indeed, they're a sort of almost a fashion in modern art, Iranian artists operating in the West, and many of whom really don't want to even refer to themselves as Iranian artists. They want to be sort of world artists, you know. And I wonder if you have a thought on that, because you can't entirely divorce yourself from your sort of your genes and your mother's milk, as it were, even if you want to. And is it even desirable? I mean, what's wrong with being an Iranian artist who speaks to the world? Just like Ferdowsi is a Persian poet, we're saying at the moment he tends only to speak to people who read Persian, unfortunately. But you see, we've lost that. Even in the 19th century, I think people were far more familiar with Persian literature generally than they are now. But you know, it is an issue, isn't it, if you have to somehow divorce yourself from your origin to reach out to a more global audience or not?
It definitely is. I think that it becomes problematic when artists tend to produce work for a specific type of audience that desires exotic work that comes out of the East, especially in this case, Iran. Well, I do it because I'm split in half. Half of my life I've lived in the West, half of it in Iran. So it when it comes out, part of it looks like Persian miniatures, part of it comes out as bacon. So I don't control it, but also I am fortunate to be a professor, so my income doesn't come from my art. The university pays me. I don't have to make art for, Iranian or Eastern dealers of art. So I don't have to tailor it for their taste. But yeah, definitely, it comes out this way. Part of it is because I was an immigrant to the United States at a young age when I was 16. So I had to go back and find the roots and. In a way, that's why I say catharsis, because in a way, it becomes therapeutic. It cures my home sickness.
Yes, thank you. I guess we're going to have to draw this to a close fairly soon. There's a nice question here, though, about landscape in the Shahnameh. I wonder, this is two things, really. I mean, Barbara touched on this, of course, by highlighting the wonderful gardens and the vegetation in some of the paintings, but how much actual textual imagery is there as well, Gabrielle, would you say? I mean, the landscape doesn't actually feature much. It's usually the sun coming up over the mountains or going down over the mountains, isn't it, sir?
Yes, and the traveling, for example, yeah. I'm thinking of the Haftghan travels through the wild. I mean, yes, there is some. I must say that, well, for example, in contemporaries of Ferdowsi, such as Farrokhi Sistani, this nature element is much more present. I think much more, at least so I do, see it at least. But I think the landscape is something which really, I always seem to look at the paintings when I think of Shahnameh landscapes, which is of course a bit strange. What I like very much, if it's that's not a landscape thing, is indeed the role of animals and this idea. I mean, I really think that is that's really very beautiful. So the idea that makes the Shahnameh also different, I suppose, from Homer, where there is a certain kind of humility, or at least in the approach of Ferdowsi, that man is not as good as they seem to think of themselves. And that's one of the things I really, so this extra layer in the Shahnameh is really, I think, unique in an epic. And in that respect, I fully agree that it should be somehow more known. But the problem is, of course, that it's not so easy to translate it into any language, although Dick Davis did a great job. Mm-hmm. And Marjolein van Zutphen in Dutch too, but then again, no one reads Dutch. So that's about it.
But Barbara, I mean, you made a very nice point about the death of Rustam and Sohrab, of the landscape sort of weeping. And in many ways, people often say, why bother to illustrate a text at all? And it's a sort of another layer of interpretation. It's sort of putting in things that aren't there in the text itself, aren't they? I mean,
yes, indeed.
So much symbolism in the trees and a dead tree or a living tree in the streams.
Yes, there was a very, I mean, they developed a very sophisticated scheme, but right back from the great Mongol Shahnameh, you've got trees speaking and indicating and bowing and all sorts of things like that, all the way through. But sometimes it gets a bit sort of automatic-y, but when it's used by a good artist, it's wonderful, and there's sort of pathetic fallacy and all this sort of stuff going on.
Yeah.
Charles, there was also this question on the other in the Shahnameh. I think we need to address that, because that is something which is, of course, there is a lot to say about this. And it's, I think, especially also in maybe in more later nationalist discourse, there is always this idea. So Iran is the ideal. And then we have the bad guys, the Turks versus the Arabs. And obviously, the end of the Shahnameh ends with it ends, of course, with the Sasanian Empire when the Arabs come in. And it's you can interpret that in various ways, and you can see indeed the Arab as the other. On the other hand, if I read this myself, I don't feel this so much. But then again, I feel also a little bit myself like the other reading the Shahnameh, so that makes it maybe difficult as well. I think the Shahnameh does reflect, and that's something I think Dick Davis has been writing about a lot. The Shahnameh does reflect the moment of time in which it was written. It's very obvious that at the time the Shahnameh was composed, there was this large influx of Central Asian Turks into what we now call Iran. And sorry for this. This is and Turkic dynasties like the Ghaznavids came in power, and before them others too, a bit more to the north. So there was this interaction between Turks and Iranians, between Turko-Tajik, if you like. And this, in a way, can be seen as represented in the Shahnameh too. That said, of course, it's also one big family that falls apart. I mean, if you take it at face value, Iraj, Tur, and Salm, they are brothers, and Tur becomes, of course, the father of Turan, the very other person. But initially, the other was, well, let's say, the own, if you can put it like that in English. I'm not really sure. I think the Shahnameh has often been used as to prove something, which sometimes I don't know whether that's really in it. And some other things, because there was also an interesting question on the figure of Katayun in the Q&A. I think there are some figures in the Shahnameh, and also the whole relation with Byzantium, for example, that are not necessarily so much. I think more research could be done on that. So I think it's a huge epic, obviously. So there's a lot more that may be done. But rather than sort of trying to describe the Shahnameh and fall for easy stereotypes, I think we should really look into this. And I'm not sure, for example, Puya, how do you think about this? I mean, how do you see the role of the other in the Shahnameh? I think I already told the person who asked this to ask you. But,
Yes, well, I agree with you. But also here and there, this border blurs. For example, with Rostam himself, he fights for the Persian king, but here and there he says, "I'm gonna go to Iran from Zabulistan to fight for the Persian king," which is really interesting to me.
Yeah.
Yes, obviously, Turan on one side and Rum on the other side, and obviously the other is always portrayed even visually. It's portrayed differently. When we say Mah, Mahru. Mah is because the moon is a circle, people wouldn't see the woman's face outside an Iranian face for a woman, but they would see one of the Kani Zakan's faces, which came from China or Turan, and they had a really round face, so they decided to say Mahru, someone that had that type of face. So yes, obviously I trace that, but also it's important how these borders are shifted and how they recognize themselves as Iranian per se.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm interested too in how this has been taken up by, for example, in Turkic princess Tikutat Kubilik, where the Karahanid rulers identify themselves with Afrasiyab, but I also think that's filling in something at a later stage because it suits a certain discourse. So that's completely another thing. But I like very much how this works, how this plays out in each and every period. So that's really there's so much in it. So it's yeah. I'm sorry for the person who asked this that I cannot really give a clearer answer. Apart from the fact that I think indeed what you say too, that boundaries should not be taken, you know, like being fixed at all. That's not the case. That's definitely true, and they change too from local to more local, so to speak. That's another thing.
Exactly. None of the cities that are mentioned in Shahnameh are now in Iran.
Yes, most of them, in the later stage, perhaps. Yes, and then you have, of course, the idea. I think that was, who was this again? I forgot his name. How awful. Munshizadeh, Davud Munshizadeh. He argues that, for example, a place like Mazandaran, which we think we know where it is, that the Mazandaran of the Shahnameh, he argues, is not in what we think it is. It was in a different place. So I'm not really, I haven't followed this up. But it's an interesting thought that we think we know things and we don't, so to speak. And also the big question is, does it matter? I mean, it doesn't perhaps it's still, yeah.
Well, we have a nice question from Alice West here. I was wondering if Barbara would like to answer it. Could you recommend any authors who deal particularly with the iconography in the Shahnameh, gestures, clothing, surrounding objects? I think this is nowadays called material culture. You can see elements in the picture that reflect the life that the artist was familiar with. Before I let Barbara answer, there's Sheila Canby's written quite a bit about this in connection with the famous Shah Tahmasp Shahnameh, which was the last one that Barbara was revealing to us earlier in her talk. Would you like to add anything, Barbara?
Well, there isn't sort of one book that is a key to the whole thing. It's been discussed in books after books, in lots of books. You could look at Canby, you could look at various things by Robert Hillenbrand. And if you get pushed, you could look at my book on Muhammad Juki. I mean, it's an expanding idea that rolls and rolls.
I think the short answer is, if anyone wants to follow up any of this panel and any of the discussions, I think we'd all be very happy to have questions. And actually, this is a question for our hidden IT person who's keeping us all sane in the background. It would be quite nice if we could have a sort of feedback thing on the BIPS website, maybe, because it would be very nice and helpful for us to know how this has been received generally, and positive or negative comments, of course, all equally welcome. I have a sense that I'm not the only one who's getting a little bit tired. It's extremely hot here. We've been at it for 2 hours. So I wonder if, unless there's anything really burning anyone wants to say, I think we should draw it to a close and get some refreshments or whatever one normally does after a public lecture. So if I may, I'd like to thank all our panelists, Gabrielle from Leiden, thank you very much, Barbara from London, and Puya from Boston, USA, and thank you very much for contributing so energetically to this panel, and I personally have enjoyed it a lot. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Charles.
Thank you.
That leave time.
Okay. Oh, bye bye, Barbara. Thank you. It's beautiful.